Hi, this is Dr. Matt Harless. I'm a residency-trained, board-certified emergency medicine physician, and my friend Laura Love has asked me to present a discussion with you about a very under-recognized and underestimated disease. I'll review with you the syndrome based on our current understanding of the various presentations, appropriate testing, diagnosis, and treatment. What we're going to explore is disease known as alpha-gal. You may be aware of it, but alpha-gal basically stands for galactose, alpha-1,3-galactose, which is a carbohydrate antigen, which is not normally found or intrinsic to primates, but is in all other mammals. And the way you get it is the tick, which feeds on a mammal, whether it's a cow, deer, dog, what have you, they all have alpha-gal antigen in their system, but it's not antigenic to them. And they pass it to the tick, which then passes it to us and when they feed on us in the secondary life stage. Interestingly, of all individuals that test positive for alpha-gal, only 4% are symptomatic. And as a result, if you have a patient present with a report of a tick bite, but no symptoms of alpha-gal, there's no reason to test them. Of the 4%, only a very small subset, also about 4%, will display a allergy to dairy products, which are mammalian byproduct, obviously, and be unable to drink milk, have butter, ice cream, cheese, etc. So, in the event that you have a patient test is positive for alpha-gal that's symptomatic with the meat allergen, routine dairy restriction is not required. Again, tick is a vector, and the specific tick is known as Amblyomma americanum, and it's commonly referred to as the lone star tick. And the reason it's called a lone star tick is that it's got a white spot on its back just below the head, if you will, where the shoulders would be, say, on a person, and it looks like a lone star. This tick is the only one that's been confirmed so far to carry the tick in the United States. And nevertheless, there are other genus and species of ticks that have been demonstrated to carry the disease in other countries and continents of the world. There's current active research on other potential tick vectors, as well as mites, specifically chiggers, that might be able to transmit it. They did fairly elaborate testing on these ticks to demonstrate that after feeding on a alpha-gal infected, or not infected, but an alpha-gal mammal, again, they all have it as a non-antigen, but it is an antigen to people. So when they tested these ticks, they found that it's in their gastrointestinal system, and particularly in the saliva. They basically will attach to the mammal, suck the blood, thereby obtaining the alpha-gal antigen, and subsequent will attach to a human where they will suck your blood, but then regurgitate saliva into the wound, causing the infection in some cases. The symptoms can be mild, moderate, severe, and even life-threatening, and occasionally death can ensue from cardiovascular collapse, from profound hypertension, and from anaphylaxis. The most common presentation is cutaneous, and the cutaneous presentation of this disease will be a profound global urticaria and intense pruritus, obviously, which is itching. And that occurs in about 80 to 85% of patients. The second most common presentation of this disease would be gastrointestinal, where it's severe, typically low abdominal pain, and associated with fecal urgency, diarrhea, occasionally nausea, vomiting. A third most common presentation in 40 to 45% of patients is a profound hypotension with near syncope or syncope. So, but it's variable because any given patient may have any or all of these symptoms. And between occurrences, the constellation of symptoms may be different. It's also interesting to note that many patients presenting to the practitioner will have become aware of the association prior to evaluation that they have a delayed association between red meat ingestion and these symptoms. But it's not until you as a clinician and are able to elicit that they had a previous tick bite that we're able to bring this all together. So really, again, the can't misdiagnosis or shouldn't misdiagnosis would be a patient presenting in the middle of the night with no other discernible cause of their urticaria with associated pruritus, and then you as the astute clinician having determined that they had red meat prior to onset, usually hours, and no other discernible cause. The onset of symptoms or susceptibility following the tick bite is typically about 2 to 3 weeks. The symptoms, again, vary, and while the classic would be middle of the night, and then that should really throw up the red flag for you to be asking these questions about tick bite, red meat ingestion, etc. It can really occur at any time of the day or night because obviously some people have significant red meat with their breakfast, say bacon or sausage. They may have it during lunch, say a deli sandwich with say pastrami and rye, or they may have it most commonly with dinner as, you know, steak or something of that nature, pork chops. But this is the only known delayed food allergen. This disease that is very frequently misdiagnosed, and it certainly as a result is very underdiagnosed. And many doctors and other practitioners, including specialists, are unaware really of the ramifications and the details and extent of the manifestations of this particular infection disease. If you don't have it in your differential diagnosis, then obviously you're not going to make the diagnosis. So a detailed history is really the key to this particular diagnosis. And whether it's the cutaneous or other manifestations, if you don't get to the crux of all the details and know to ask these questions, the patient's not likely to offer them. But because the manifestations are each and of themselves fairly common and with so many other potential causes, you have to really rule out these other causes. So the gastrointestinal symptoms really will require you to know that they've had recurrences and they've had previous evaluations, and the previous evaluations have been comprehensive with negative workups, including many will have undergone surgical consultations, presumed peritonitis as, you know, surgical abdomen, and having undergone previous abdominal CT, ultrasound, or other modalities. For instance, in females, it may include looking at things like ovarian cysts, ruptured cysts, etc. The gastroenterology referral is commonly also haven't been reported in these patients, and typically with fecal occult blood, which we can do as well, but EGD and colonoscopy. The typical workup for the hypotensive-related syncope includes extensive cardiac testing initially, and that would include tilt tests, echocardiogram, Holter and or event monitoring, cardiolite stress test, and EKG. The EKG is particularly important. Again, we can get that as primary providers, and this to rule out other causes of hypertension and syncope, and most importantly in that list would be tachy and bradydysrhythmias, long QT syndrome associated with sudden cardiac death, and Brugada criteria, also potentially associated with sudden cardiac death. And these are essential that you read and learn about Brugada criteria, which are beyond the scope of this particular conversation. And of course, then the potential of things like stable ventricular tachycardia, which may be paroxysmal. In case of syncope, what's unusual is that it's very prolonged compared to typical syncope, which lasts seconds to minutes. And this syncope typically lasts minutes to hours. And I would say not commonly 20 minutes to 2 hours, which is totally atypical for any kind of typical syncope. And as a result, it, in addition to cardiologist referral, might also include neurologist referral for an EEG for an atypical seizure and MRA of the head and neck for other ominous conditions that may manifest like this. If no prior testing revealed a solid cause, it would be the reason to go through that expensive testing. The initial workup on presentation to the provider, that would be you, once alpha-gal is suspected, would include an EKG, continuous cardiac monitoring, comprehensive blood work, including CBC and CMP, and especially looking for anemia as a cause of lightheadedness or passing out, and electrolytes, looking specifically sodium, potassium, renal function, and glucose. And of course, we can get an AccuCheck if the patient's unstable immediately. And then an alpha-gal panel. Now, again, a lot of people don't know about it to even order it, but once you have now become aware through this discussion, it should be really in the front of your mind that in these appropriate patients, they should have an IgE alpha-gal beef, pork, and lamb antibody level profile ordered. They take about a week to come back, but if you have elevated levels, significantly elevated levels, particularly with suggestive symptoms, it makes the diagnosis. Fortunately, some affected patients may be able to eat red meat again after years, as long as or barring any further exposure and reinfection. Treatment is symptomatic on presentation. It'd be directed by the presenting chief complaint, physical exam, and vital sign findings, which may include implementing an anaphylactic algorithm where appropriate. Ultimately, once highly suspect and definitely after confirmed by positive alpha-gal antibody testing, strict avoidance of all red meat and mammalian-derived red meat products, including organ sauces, additives, transplant, especially porcine heart valves, cosmetics, gelatin, which is complicated because that includes encapsulated medications, gummy bears, jelly beans, marshmallows, puddings, jello, etc., and heparin, which is frequently porcine-derived, and finally antivenin or antivenom for snake bite. It used to be all equine-derived, but now there are alternatives. So those are just important things to think of because a lot of the cardiothoracic surgeons and cardiologists don't even know about this diagnosis. And if they implant a porcine or bovine valve in a patient's heart and they come in anaphylaxis, unless you make that diagnosis, the patient's going to die. So it's really important to be aware of it. The diagnosis is really serious and life-changing, if not fatal. So my story is that it took me 10 years to finally diagnose and solve the puzzle because about 10 or 12 years ago, I started having episodic, idiosyncratic episodes of near syncope or syncope associated with profound diaphoresis, and again, very prolonged. And since the onset of the illness, I might have had 25 such episodes. And again, they're occasionally very prolonged and worrisome, have also resulted in injuries and humiliation. So I've had episodes that have occurred on transcontinental flights, resulting in people on plane unable to unload until, you know, they brought a gurney in and take me into the main hub of the airport where I had to refuse treatment to get back on my flight. I've had it occur at many events, restaurants, and various things. And it's sometimes associated with incontinence of either bowel or bladder because you have no blood pressure. And so I secondarily developed about 5 or 6 years ago the GI manifestations. So I started off with the least common, the hypotension, syncope, and diaphoresis, and then developed the severe abdominal pain. In fact, it felt like I'd ruptured a diverticulum, and sudden onset of fecal urgency, plus or minus diarrhea. And it wasn't until I had the most common symptom, which was the profound pruritus with hives or urticaria, that I ultimately self-diagnosed for the first time in my career, having diagnosed this syndrome due to a discussion with a radiologist friend of mine with a friend of his who he was asking me about the disease, and I didn't really know anything about it other than, hey, you get bit by a tick, you can't eat red meat. That's about all I knew about it, and also haven't read a paper. So I was sure I had it, and I contacted my PCP the next day and scheduled an appointment to have the blood work done. And even at that time, he was really reluctant and unwilling to do the test. And I drove an hour to his office and got home and was frustrated and called him back and more or less insisted that he did it. And all the real results came back exponentially elevated. I wasn't surprised he was. I had an episode with the former neighbor out here in the country. You know, that's somebody that's a half mile away. And it turned out that I had taken his job when I moved to town many years ago. And he nevertheless remained a friend. He sold his farm and became my chairman of emergency medicine, as well as chief of staff, and had an occurrence with he and his wife on her birthday going to a concert and driving on the highway. I suddenly had presyncopal symptoms, told him, he asked me to pull off the next exit. I made it clear I couldn't make it to the next exit, so I managed to get to the berm of the road where I pulled off. I couldn't get thoughts or speech together. Then I lost my eyesight, everything turned white, and as I tried to switch seats in the car, I ended up about 40 feet down the side of the hill in deep grass on the side of I-81 in Virginia. And the only thing I could think is, why am I laying face down in 3 foot tall grass full of ticks and chiggers? So I managed to get myself up, got to the car, and he was shocked that I was ashen gray. He couldn't get a pulse. And when I finally was feeling better and color was coming back to my vision, an ambulance arrived and they got initially couldn't get a blood pressure, but subsequently got a blood pressure of 60 over 30. And I was feeling much better. So I have no idea how low it went, but that's what can result in cardiovascular collapse. And it's happened a number of times. I've made my adult children aware that, you know, if something happens, that's likely what it was. You can't be too concerned about it. You just got to avoid any kind of exposure. And I really not had any symptoms since the very careful avoidance of all red meat products. But there are some idiosyncrasies within it. For instance, there are perfectly healthy people, young people that have no history except having tested positive for alpha-gal. And where I live, there are a lot of farmers, and there are reports of people having anaphylaxis and or death from a cow belch or flatus. There are also reports of people having, again, cardiovascular collapse and anaphylaxis or death from dog flatus or dog saliva. So I'm not ready to get rid of my dog, but I certainly wash my hands more often than I used to. So it's really a very interesting, life-changing disease. And again, because I had the episode with my boss and his wife, he went to the CEO and CMO of the hospital, and I was strongly encouraged to undergo all the aforementioned testing, and it was tens of thousands of dollars worth of workup. But fortunately, that all came back negative. And again, this being a diagnosis of exclusion, you have to make sure it's not something else first, but the very detailed, careful history is going to point you in the right direction. Again, if you don't think about it, you're not going to make the diagnosis. So I want to thank Dr. Platts-Mills and Dr. Jeff Wilson and Dr. Dave Cummins out of University of Virginia Medical Center, who have really been the pioneers in research and discovery of this interesting association between red meat allergy and tick exposure. I really encourage you to read their articles on this if you're interested. And Dr. Cummins is subsequently at UNC Chapel Hill, where his lab continues trying to further identify all the manifestations of this infection disease. There are many new avenues being investigated, including possible associated cardiovascular or vasculopathy resulting in premature stroke and heart attack, and looking again for other vectors. So again, you have to know about a disease for you to consider it in your differential diagnosis before being able to diagnose it. And you're in a career that requires continuous education, and you'll never know it all, but you can't ever stop trying. Thank you so much for your attention, and I hope you have a blessed rest of your day. This is Matt Harless, checking out.